Don't listen to your neighbor. That is our advice for our billboard from our guest today. Stick around to the end to hear why we don't want to listen to our neighbor. Today, I'm talking with Terrell. We're talking about developmental coordination disorder and how to take a problem-solving approach for self-care, leisure, and participation. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. If you're a new parent to special education or a seasoned parent sitting at the table, come join us for our conversation, get a little broader scope, and see how you can better support your student. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. I'm a mom and special educator. I have sat on both sides of the IEP table as a parent and a professional. Over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick-butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a like and a follow. Let's get ready to strategize. Welcome, Terrell. Thank you for joining us. And I appreciate you coming on today to talk about this very important topic that a lot of people don't know about, developmental coordination disorder. And I'm excited to dive in. But first and foremost, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you just tell folks a little bit about you and what you do and how you are that strategist for our special education folks or our students that need support?
I am a pediatric physical therapist with 45 years experience. I started my career in rehabilitation working on multidisciplinary teams, and I have been a part of a multidisciplinary team during my entire career. I started my career in Canada, and then I moved to Texas where I was the senior physical therapist on the neurology service at Baylor Hospital, where eventually we were working with infants and children. When I went back to school, 2000-ish, and I was studying for my clinical doctorate in physical therapy, one of the things that my advisor was discussing a lot was developmental coordination disorder. And where he had gotten a lot of his information from was from McMaster University in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, which was, it's Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, sorry. And the work of CanChild, which is an organization in Canada dedicated to children that have special needs. Through my advisor, I started looking at developmental coordination disorder, and in my mind, it looked an awful lot like what my OT colleagues are calling developmental dyspraxia. Yet at that time, I believe way back then, that was probably a DSM-3, they were probably coded differently. One was lack of coordination, and the other one, I don't remember what it was called. But in any event, they weren't considered to be synonymous in any way whatsoever. And dyspraxia seemed to be the term that many of the clients, when I had a private practice with an OT, they came in with the diagnosis of developmental dyspraxia. Over the years, things have changed in that. Now, in the United States, they are recognizing developmental coordination disorder as a distinct disorder that is very similar to developmental dyspraxia. Up until now, children that present, much like someone I might have seen yesterday here that has got a diagnosis of DCD, perhaps in the past that may not have been the diagnosis that they might have been given. They might have been given a diagnosis of dyspraxia. Some time ago, the United States and all the powers that be have decided to adopt developmental coordination disorder, even though it has been studied thoroughly in many Scandinavian countries and in Canada and has been used, and there are treatments designed for it for many years. This is just something that is, to me, peculiar, but it's actually very new here. And the reason that I think it is so important for all of us to come together as a community with this diagnosis is because generally it could be a physical therapist that sees this person first because of a motor coordination problem. It could be an occupational therapist because of self-care problems or emotional regulation problems. It could be a psychologist, again, because of emotional problems, issues the parents may be having at home with the child, or it could be a speech therapist because there are some issues with language, you know, that may be a part of all of this. And the thing about this diagnosis is, I really don't believe that just one of us can do this. I think we need to function as a team. And that's why I think it's really important to move this diagnosis away from something that is dyspraxia, which really just infers that there are certain things going on, and it's actually a lot more complex than the original diagnosis of dyspraxia. The description is more complex.
So let's kind of go back a step back before we move forward to talk about a deeper dive in that developmental coordination disorder. Can you help some of our listeners distinguish between, you had mentioned OT and PT. So what are some reasons a child may need OT, and what are some reasons that a child may need PT? Just like a quick little.
Okay. I would say that, first of all, it depends where you live, because it's a very regional thing that depends on where you live. There are certain areas, like, I mean, NICU's a great example. There are places where the neonatal intensive care unit and care of infants that have motor difficulties is solely under the umbrella of occupational therapy. And there are hospital centers all over the world where it's solely under physical therapy. So I think that especially in children, there's a tremendous amount of overlap. And I think that there's actually more similarities than there are differences. You know, we both work with clients across lifespan. We both evaluate clients to understand their strengths. And our job is to educate and train families, caregivers, and so that they can improve client safety and client skills. I would say that when it comes to developmental coordination disorder, the physical therapist would be more involved in the larger muscle group movements, and the occupational therapist may be involved in the finer movements, given that the foundations of physical therapy are in physical rehabilitation and a lot of muscles, and the foundations of occupational therapy are also in physical rehabilitation, but also mental health. And they have, with children, an integral part of their educational experience.
So thinking of a school and an IEP team, kind of a twofold question, what does that assessment look like for determining the developmental coordination disorder? And then the second part is, can schools help play a role in that assessment?
Okay. So the actual diagnosis of developmental coordination disorder, a person with a doctorate degree can actually call somebody an F80, can call a child F82. Okay. However, I would strongly suggest that that diagnosis came from someone that had done, was either a neurologist or had done a neuro, that had done a neuropsych evaluation. So I would think that those things would have to be done. And I don't think that the level of the school, I think, is going to notice the child is having problems. How the therapist can help is, if there is a therapist involved, is to communicate with the school and try and get everybody to find out, you know, what is going on. Are they talking? Is the child having problems with fine motor performance? And is their fine motor performance impaired? Are they writing slowly? Are they having trouble with use of scissors? Are they having trouble dressing? Well, that's going to fall, you know, into more of the realm of an OT. For the PT, are they having problems on the playground with walking, carrying their lunch tray, posture, sitting in their chair? And I just don't think it's as clear cut as it would be in adult rehab, where the physical therapist teaches the person to stand and the occupational therapist teaches them to brush their teeth while they're standing. I don't see it as such a division. I really see it at much more as a collaborative, multi-layered, you know, integrated effort from all disciplines to help these children.
What are some common signs or symptoms? You've kind of mentioned a few just in this initial part of our conversation today, but what can some common signs or symptoms of DCD for either parents to look out for or educators or professionals supporting a student?
Well, generally, the DSM-5 has criteria that you have to meet in order to get the diagnosis. And the first one is motor performance deficits, having problems doing things that most kids can do every day, difficulty with participation and other activities of daily living. Generally, the onset is very early, and there are no other exclusionary conditions that could explain what you're seeing. So those things have to be met in order for the child to meet the criteria for the DSM-5 diagnosis. And the risk factors are generally a child that may have been born less than 1,500 grams, which have been less than 3 pounds, a child that would be born prematurely, less than 37 weeks, and maybe possibly maternal drug or alcohol use, and that's still out there. Oh, one more. If there's someone else in the family that possibly presents as such, we still haven't made the connection that you can, in fact, say that that's why it is. However, that is something to be considered in the discussion.
Can DCD co-occur with other developmental disabilities? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, it's most likely going to co-occur with difficulties with executive function and probably most commonly with ADHD. So a lot of the gross motor problems can be actually attributed to attention problems in some individuals with DCD. And recently, in November of 2022, a new art journal article came out from the Netherlands, and they actually have divided DCD now into four subtypes, four clusters. In the clusters, you're able to see some of these kids have more problems with fine motor control. Some of these kids have more problems with visual perception, like drawing conclusions from information that they see. Some children have more problems with visual spatial, like where are objects in space? Where are their body parts in relation to other body parts? Where are they in relation to other children? If you have difficulty processing that visual, you know, spatial sensory information, it can definitely impact you academically and also your social relationships.
What are the four subtypes?
Well, the four subtypes are, I just read the article within the last week because I just got it. They're divided into four clusters, cluster 1, 2, 3, and 4. And there were just differences in the clusters, like the cluster one has the children had an average IQ, visual perception and VMI were within normal limits, but their motor skills were at risk as demonstrated by their fine motor control on the BIRI and their gross motor on the movement ABC. Cluster two, average IQ, manual dexterity and VMI were normal. Ball and balance skills were very much involved. And scores in cluster two were higher on all metrics except ball skills and balance. Cluster three, your IQ and your BIRI VMI are within normal limits. Ball skills are the lowest of all the clusters. And I have seen kids like this. They can learn absolutely everything but that. Relative to the sample, cluster three had near or below the grand mean for normal performance IQ, manual dexterity, and visual perception. And cluster four, they had very well-developed hand skills. And I'm seeing a child like this right now. That is all that he is great at. And he is great at that. But you ask him to go up the stairs, and he has so much difficulty separating his body and planning that. But the children in cluster four have, again, besides the well-developed ball skills, they have average verbal IQ, average BIRI visual perception, and relative to the sample, what they found out with cluster four is their ball and balance skills were so much more above average. And however, the performance IQ in cluster four was below mean of the whole sample. So I just think it's fascinating because when we work with neurodiversity, it doesn't matter how many children you see, and even if they're identical twins and they have the same diagnosis, I've never seen two children that are the same ever. And as I've gone through all this DCD, because I'm very interested in this condition, and as I've gone through that and I looked at all the clusters, I was like, that's another reason why they were all different. It wasn't their own individual differences. It's also the description of the presentation. And it wasn't my imagination either. You know, like why can this child catch a ball? And that's the best skill he has. And why does this child over here, everything else, he's learning to do all sorts of things, fine motors moving along, you know, but I can't get him to catch a ball to save his life. So, you know, it's really interesting. And I guess heterogeneity, I mean, and now even more so that, you know, that this article came out with actually giving them clusters.
Can you help us understand the emotional part that comes into play? You had mentioned that could be an impact for a child that's identified with DCD. What would that look like, and how do we better support that child?
Well, I mean, I think that's sort of multifaceted. One is parents. If you know your child has DCD and you're educated about that, you know that there's a possibility that this is something they're going to have for life. So I think that, you know, teaching your child, you know, self-advocacy and, you know, all those things are extremely, extremely important, because emotionally, I think what this can look like is a child that's really struggling to get dressed, struggling to keep up, struggling to write as fast as their peers, struggling to get dressed to make it outside in the playground on time, struggling in the playground because they can't do some of that fancy stuff in the playground that some of their peers can do. And I think that it can impact their self-esteem very, very much so, very, very, very much like what the original description of developmental dyspraxia was. I mean, they were in 1990, 30 something years ago, they were way onto the fact that, even though I don't think they had the whole picture, but they were very, very much onto the fact that this could, you know, impact, you know, a child's sense of self. And also the other things that would go along with that, the anxiety and things like that, because you can't keep up, and the frustration.
Yeah. So what does the PT, what do you focus on as a PT when it comes to DCD?
Like, how would I evaluate them? Or, I mean, I would focus on whatever we determine the goals are. Okay. And so whatever the goals are, those are the things we're going to focus on. And as we've described with four different clusters of this situation, I'm going to look more carefully for clusters. And what I want to be able to do is to be able to meet the child's goals and to meet the parents' goals. I mean, generally these children, almost whatever cluster they're in, they're going to have trouble with balance, you know, on surfaces. And part of my job, I think, would be, you know, an assessment of their body and their, you know, are their feet in good alignment, their hips in good alignment, you know, do they need inserts in their shoes in order to be able to navigate surfaces, you know, better? What does their walking look like? What does their running look like? What is their strength like? Is their strength the way that it is because of something that's inherently kind of, the muscles are not firing maybe the way that you want them to be? Or is it more that their strength is okay, but they don't really know what to do with the strength that they have. As a PT, I would do movement analysis. Mature movement is characterized by, you know, head moving on this part staying stable, you know, upper body moving on the bottom part of the body staying stable, and making sure that when that person is moving place to place, you're using a variety of movement patterns to get from place to place, because we use multiple patterns to move from place to place. So my assessment is also going to be a lot of observation, you know, on how does a child actually do that? How do they get up, and how do they manage, you know, going over, getting a ball, setting a game up for us, whatever, you know, whatever the case may be. I would look at posture. Posture is really important. Posture impacts output of handwriting, and that could be a whole other podcast if you want to do that. So I think that I would look at all those things. And the other thing that I do with all patients, is this a good time to mention this, the OPM? the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure. I have for many years used the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure with my clients. It is a client reported list of things that are important to the family. These things are going to, you know, fall in the areas of self-care, leisure, and participation. And one of the things that I think is critically important is that my goals match the child's goals, match the parent's goals. And oftentimes what happens is something may be importance of a 5 to a parent, but to the child, it's an 8. And sometimes you can have one parent that thinks ball, catch, and throw is a 0 and they don't care, but the other parent thinks it's a 10. So I think that it's very important to have the discussion about goals and setting goals with the family so that everybody is going to be working on this together. And so not only do I think that all the team members need to be on the same page, I highly recommend that if at all possible, however you have to manage it, try and get the parents and the family and the child on the same page. Get the, you know, like, and I do things like, well, let the mom, you know, give the mom 2 and you take 2, you know, like just negotiate. Like if this is important to her, but this isn't important. And generally this conversation would be a child maybe 8 or up that I would be having with. But there are kids that are 5 or 6 that can tell you what they can't do. And it may not be something that you saw. You know, they may tell you, I can't hang up my coat at school on the rack. I can't snap the top button on my pants. You know, things that you wouldn't even think about. Or you say to the parent, here you are as a PT, what's the biggest problem? My child has not washed their hair in a month. And I'm like, but you know what? That's really important. That says a lot about, but you know, usually kids that have spatial problems, washing hair is very difficult for them and tending to self-care is difficult for them. But then I think that leads me to start to look at, you know, let's try to get that problem solved. And, you know, let me get an OT here helping me. You know, like, I just think we have to listen to what they're telling us. And then we know who the next person is to ask. You know, if you're telling me that school's saying you're struggling, then the child needs a neuropsych evaluation. And we need to find somebody that's going to be able to do that, you know, for them to be able to help them. And unfortunately, now that's a little difficult because of everybody's backlog. But the thing is to be able to pivot and direct the family so that they get all the information that they need to address the motor and the executive function concerns, because they are coexisting and they are impacting one another.
Let's talk about the executive function component. So what executive function skills can DCD impact?
I would say it's going to impact attention and paying attention. It's going to perhaps impact inhibitory control, like that feedback, like knowing that you made a mistake, error correction, detection. I think that would be impacted because these children have tremendous difficulty learning new skills. And oftentimes they have difficulty processing information. And so if you have difficulty processing information and you have lapses in attention, one could understand why they're going to have problems perhaps on a playground that may or may not be related to muscles, or it may be. And I think that our job is to determine what, you know, what's contributing and how do we get this child to a place where they can function with their peers and participate for lifetime health and wellness.
So part of an IEP team, what are some common school accommodations that you have seen to kind of help support all of this, the DCD, specifically though, the processing information, the attention, that executive function component? Have you seen accommodations that have really been of value for students identified with DCD?
I don't have a whole lot of experience working with older kids that would be in a more public school setting. And that's also more difficult to get accommodations in that setting. I certainly have had experience with younger children, you know, when they're 4 or 5. So it's not really a formal IEP, but you certainly getting supports in place, you know, to try and help the child meet their milestones. For the older children, in my understanding is that if you have a diagnosis of DCD and you're not able to participate in PE, I mean, you could get adapted PE. There, you know, there's something you could do. You could also have peer interactions. You know, there are peers that can help other kids do stuff. Like if a child can throw a ball, but another child can run, if you've got a good inclusion thing going at your school, you can make someone the thrower and someone the runner, and then they're both in the game. You know, I know people don't think these things through that way, but it's very, very possible to include everybody if we were to think of it and sort of and frame it that way. And so for, you know, and in school, I mean, if they're not safe on stairs, I mean, certainly the, you know, a PT can go in and work with the child. But I mean, those would have to be very involved children for physical therapists to get into a school, an elementary school, and certainly a middle school. It would certainly be easier, you know, to maybe get OT for pull out. But once again, I don't think those things happen until the child's older. It's not until they're 8 or 9 and finally, because they can't find anything that's wrong, right? The MRI is normal. This is normal. That's normal. There's no other obvious thing. The child is struggling, you know, and then finally they go and they send the child for a neuropsych eval. And then they realize that there are issues, you know, in their profile that could be contributing to their difficulties with gross motor skills or vice versa. And a lot of it, you know, has to do with they're not making a memory of when they make a mistake. You know, like when they perform something for the first time, that's not a reference for them for future actions. They don't have the stored experience, and they can't use that, you know, to generate in intended movement. So I mean, I think that, you know, our job is to try and help them do that. And you can help the school with strategies if they're willing to work with you. But again, as a PT, if a child can get into a classroom and sit in a chair, they're not going to get PT services at school. They could get OT, but they wouldn't get PT.
So as an outside professional, and I really like how you kind of define that, making a memory to help support future action. So from your lens and your expertise, what is an example of how you would help a child create that memory so that they could repeat the success?
I'm glad you asked that, because one of the main outcome measures that's used for DCD in the literature is the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure that I mentioned, and also the Performance Quality Rating Scale, I believe, is used also. There is an approach to working with these children, and it's called the Cognitive Orientation Approach to Daily Occupational Performance. It was originally developed for occupational therapists also, and has now been generalized for use across all disciplines. And the principles of co-op or cognitive orientation to daily performance, and this could be applicable to anybody that's working with the child, and there are 4 principles. And this is to get that internal representation that we're speaking of. You ask the child has to have average intelligence. The child has to be able to understand you. These children are not children that have below average intelligence, because otherwise they don't have this diagnosis. Okay, so to use co-op though, the child has to be able to answer these questions. Now, there are some kids that are 5 or 6 that are incredible with this strategy. And sometimes that happens in a brighter kid, and sometimes that happens in a kid that is just more interested or more motivated, you know, in what you're doing than the next child. And the 4 principles of co-op are, what is your goal? And the child says, I'm going to throw the ball to the tower. Okay. And then I say, okay, what is your plan? My plan is to push the ball. This is what I want forward, because I don't want to go to either side of the target. My plan is to push the ball forward, and I'm going to try and hit the yellow box. Okay. Do it. And then I'm quiet. You cannot speak when children are performing. They do it. And then you say, the check is what happened. So the child will say, I missed the yellow box by this much. Or I keep on throwing the ball over that way. Or I threw the ball too high. I threw the ball too low. And then you say, okay, what would we do next time? They tell you how to refine it. And then you try again. And then if the child says to you, I am going to throw the ball to the blue box, honestly, by about the third time, that ball hits the box almost every single time. Okay, now you have to sometimes figure out how far away you need to be to get success. And it may not be the distance that's age appropriate, but it makes the kid feel they can do it. And then you move back. But it's just a matter, it's a matter of also getting the child to recognize error detection. Because if you leave them to practice stuff on their own, like many of these kids have been doing since they're 9 and we find out they have DCD, all they're doing is reinforcing their errors. They're not correcting their errors, which is why we have this huge push to recognize children earlier. And it's hard. It's hard to do because there's no explanation. And when children are, their motor coordination is not developing well at an age of 1 or 2, there's still a lot of wait and see, because there is a lot of variety in trajectory of motor development. And especially now, even more so now than ever before. So, you know, I think that the co-op is a very, very valuable evidence-based tool that is very, very useful for all disciplines working with kids with DCD. And it's also applicable to, I have 2 children that are high-functioning autism, and they're both bright, and they're under 8, and they both respond very well to this. It keeps them in the minute. It keeps those children in the moment. Because in that moment, we're not thinking about anything else excepting that hitting that yellow box. That's all we're doing, ball to box. It's not watch the ball. I don't think that's a particularly helpful command. You know, keep your eye on the ball. That's not a particularly helpful command for these children either. Watch the ball come into your hand. That is, because then you're giving them the 2 things that they need to attend to, you know. And then you can also say at the beginning of it, before you start, where are my hands? And just orient them to where we both are in space, and then go through your goal plan, do check. And one little girl I saw yesterday, she's 9, she's older. She's another person that was diagnosed later. However, she's really getting great at saying, you know, I didn't think about it before I did it. And I it's like, yay. That's so great. You know, I mean, too bad you didn't start doing this many years ago, but it's okay because now you are. She's really made some nice progress. Now, do I think she's going to still have some difficulties over time? Maybe. But her abilities now to self-monitor are much better, and she's performing better at soccer. And she was performing better at lacrosse before they finished her season. There's really something to bringing it back to the child in terms of, if you can find out what's important to them and get some buy-in from them. And then the child has got to learn to monitor and manage their own performance so they can learn new strategies. And that may include OT strategies, because these kids do have some underlying sensory issues, and some of these children respond very well to having sensory strategies addressed. Some of these kids don't respond very well to that at all, which is different than the original definition of dyspraxia, which spoke about impaired tactile proprioception and vestibular dysfunction, and left it though wide open for it really to be wider you know, and it was really described as a problem of doing. And it really is a problem and problem of doing. And again, back in 1990, you know, to the credit of, you know, Fisher, Murray, and Bundy, that wrote the sensory integration theory and practice, you know, they said, they left it wide open that this developmental dyspraxia is a multifaceted thing that impacts daily life, and learning new tasks can be very difficult. And it's the same description. The only thing that's different is they give the reason for it as being sensory in nature. And I think that there are definitely, and every child is different, sensory contributions and sensory things that can help. However, I think we need to be looking more initially at motor coordination and executive function. And then with a good OT on board, they've got sensory strategies in their back pocket that they're going to pull out and help you with. You know, so it's the developmental coordination disorder has moved us to understand this a little bit beyond sensory issues, even though there are certainly sensory impairments or contributors or sensory issues that develop over time because of lack of experience or such frustration, things like that.
Well, the cognitive oriented approach, I can see how it would be incredibly valuable in a lot of different areas, right? So if we're thinking about goal, plan, do, and check, I'm thinking from a parent standpoint, whether that is something, you know, and still pulling in this executive function, processing memory, attention, and, you know, then our spatial awareness and such, but say, you know, brushing the teeth, what does that look like? What is our goal? What is the plan? And then being quiet while they do that, which can be hard as a parent, right? You want to kind of interject to help, help, help. But if we just sit back and then have the child verbalize, you know, how did that go? What did that look like? And that really coming into more of the, not the management role, but just that kind of consultant role as a parent to that child. And then in a classroom setting, the same thing. And you could see where goal, plan, do, and check could work for academics. It could work for social situations. Yes. It could work for a lot of different things. And easily the IEP team could translate a IEP goal that would have a student work on these skills, goal, plan, do, and check, again, you know, in all facets of the school day. And we could easily collect data on that and what does that look like and add that to the present level in an IEP. So I think it's really interesting that that is the focus, but incredibly valuable, you know, beyond a PT round, that it could really be applicable to all different things.
Absolutely. I mean, it co-op is a client-centered approach, right? I mean, it's a problem-solving approach, and you're leaving the problem-solving to the child, and you want them to get skill acquisition through using their strategies and through this process of discovery or guided discovery. I mean, that's what we want the child to do, and that's why the externals don't work. You can't sit there and say, you have to stand like this. You have to do, you have to have the child do it. And they have to create that internal model so that they improve with their planning, sequencing, organizational. I mean, there's some more executive function stuff. I mean, so that they, you know, they improve in all those things, but they can only do that if they're the problem solver, because the issue is they're not getting the message. They're not learning it the first time around. And because it takes so long often for them to be identified, they've practiced the wrong things for a very, very, very long time, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm just shaking my head just as a mom, as a parent, as a special educator, professional, having that problem solving aspect really then translates throughout school, post-secondary, in the workforce as an adult, And then really truly helps with those self-advocacy skills, right? Because you're reflecting on what went well, what didn't go well, how can I do this? And then reducing that frustration for that individual.
Right. And you're kind of getting back, you know, to your point about school. I mean, it used to be, granted, like when I was studying all of this, we had a lot more papers than we do now, you know, but I mean, the things they used to talk about for school modifications were, you know, decreasing the amount of paper the child took home, decreasing the number of books that they took home, decreasing the number of folders that they took home, or, you know, or pencils or whatever, anything that they need to complete a project, you know, they need a little bit of assistance with, and the school can definitely help with that. And I think that we also have to be mindful of the family, and here, and especially the area that we live in, you know, the family and the cultural expectations, and assist families in matching interests, skills, and expectations with ours and with their children. So, you know, I think that that's another area too that we have to sort out. We don't just jump in and say, we need to do this so that I can meet my goals. I think what we need to do is we need to sit there and we need to, you know, we need to assess the risk management if you have a clumsy child. And the most important thing I want to hear is, what are the goals of the parents and what are the goals of the child? Because that is where I'm going to meet them. That's where we're starting. And I'm going to actually build in everything they think is important within reason, but I'm gonna do that so that I can meet them where they are, and also try to help them understand that, you know, there is a possibility, like you said, that this is a lifelong thing. And when you look ahead to, you know, kids in middle school and driving and risk taking and all those other things, it becomes, you know, a whole bunch of other things I don't have personal experience with, because I don't, you know, I don't work with children that are older, you know, although I will say that in my experience, I have worked with kids that as they got older, they're really doing everything in their lives that they need. They're living full lives. So, you know, I'm always hopeful that, you know, that there are ways to help these children. And I think some of them, it may be easier to help than others. And that depends on their presentation. And that depends on their environment. You know, it's genetics and environment, like everything else, I think.
Absolutely. And I love that we're matching interest and expectations. And I would also, you know, prioritizing, you know, what is important for the family as a system. And then, you know, to help that family then communicate their priorities with the school, so that we can start to bridge that gap, not only between home and school, but from the medical model where you're coming from to the educational model, to really ensure that we're supporting this child, this student, in a way that is going to help them grow and learn the best that they can. So how can we help teach students that to internally check what they are doing? How do you help them to do that? Is that practice, or what does that look like?
Well, I think intensive practice matters, but what you can't intensively practice is errors. So, you know, that's where we get stuck. You know, I was fortunate to participate in some research at Columbia University on intensive practice in therapy. And I do believe that intensive practice works, but I also believe that there are other things that play into that. I think there are sometimes intensive practice can be carried on by other individuals besides me. And it just depends on the environment and sort of who's willing to pick up the ball. I do think that the older children, one of the things that can, you don't want to scare a younger child. However, I think it's really important if a child has not been that active and they have decreased aerobic power and they have decreased strength, it's not a bad idea to have a discussion, a light discussion, about lifetime health and wellness. You know, I mean, you cannot get out of breath getting dressed and tying up your shoes and you're done for the day, because that's not healthy living. So I think you have to try to get everybody, you know, on the same page as far as that goes. And there's some restrictions and affordances for that also, depending on the, you know, environment, you know, in which they live in. And you really want to prevent any kind of secondary issues from this. You don't want to have them have muscle tightness. You don't want to have them, you know, be unable to walk up a flight of stairs and get up, you know, and get out of breath, you know. And I think that the your question is really good, because we need to know, is the intervention working? And one of the ways that we can know is the intervention working is if with co-op, you can ask parents to do it, right? Like you try give them a couple of, you know, on their goal list, try a goal plan, do check on that, and then see what happens. And then they maybe start to talk to their child in a different sort of a way. And not that they're going into any of this by harming them. This is how we're educating them, to try to help them help their child by letting their child solve their own problems. But we have to be able to guide them in a direction that they'll be able to do that. And sometimes we need tons of sensory strategies from an OT in order to get them in the right place to be able to carry out what we're talking about. And sometimes that's not necessary. However, again, at the end of the day, I would still say that there needs to be, with these children, if there's a language issue, there needs to be a speech therapist. There almost always should be an OT and a PT, and not one at the exclusion of the other, because I can't do their job and they can't do mine. I know about balance, they know about handwriting, and we both need to be working on that. And they need to spend all their time on the visual perception and the visual motor and the fine motor control stuff. And then my job is the larger muscle groups, the running, the jumping, the playing on the playground. And then perhaps they need help with social skills. And maybe there's another individual that we need to bring in from the medical community to be able to assist the family. And I think as a therapist, we need to know when it's time for me to stop and somebody else to come in, so we don't overload the family. However, from the get-go, I just think it's super, super important, you know, that we are communicating, you know, and coordinating with other personnel, because this isn't something that I don't think any one of us can do by ourselves.
Not at all. And that's why even, you know, taking it back to kind of that school lens, having that IEP team approach and having the professionals, including the parent, communicate and collaborate to better ensure support is taking place at school, and then having outside professionals communicate and collaborate, and even encouraging that with the school team to see what kind of accommodation supports goals are needed to better support this child throughout the day. As we kind of wind down here, what should I have asked that I didn't know enough to ask?
Oh, you're pretty good, Wendy. I don't know. Your question list was like, whoa, could she ask me anything else? I think the only thing I might want to add is the tools that we might use.
Please,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. So definitely for occupational therapy, because of my education, I know how to do a VMI, but I'm not going to do a VMI, because my OT counterparts, my trusted the OTs I trust, I want them to do it. And I want them to explain to me, you know, the difference between the motor, you know, the motor control and the visual perception, and the visual spatial and all those kinds of things. So they definitely need a VMI. I would say that if you had an OT on board and they were to do a sensory processing measure, I think the biggest bang that we would get out of that is that there you would get the school involved. And if you were doing the sensory processing measure, the OT could maybe help the family with strategies. And from the sensory processing measure, you also get participation. And if the school says they're not participating, but the parents are not aware of the fact that they're not participating, then you right away have, you know, stumbled upon something that needs to be addressed. Okay. And then as far as motor tests are concerned, the test that's used mostly in the literature, even though the Brunix has been used, but the one that has been used the most for developmental coordination disorder is the movement ABC2, That's the movement assessment battery for children. It identifies mild to moderate movement disabilities in children, and it can help with clinical explanations and intervention planning. The nice thing about the movement ABC, especially the PT, is that each age band has a behavioral checklist. So you can say, you know, not persistent. All sorts of words that sort of lead you down an executive function path, you know, where you get to see, you know, frustrates easily, overestimates abilities, underestimates abilities, like those kinds of things. So I can put those comfortably into a report without feeling like I'm going into anyone else's lane. Okay. So all I'm doing is reporting the behaviors from the movement ABC checklist, which is a tool that is supposed to be used by OTs and PTs. And the MABC checklist can also be taken to the school. And again, similar to the sensory processing measure, we can see where there's a difference in what the school sees and what the parents see. And sometimes if it's the same, I mean, then you're off to the races because you have a discussion and you have everybody, you know, on a similar page. And, you know, and any one of these parent reports, if something, you know, I had this happen recently where, you know, something comes out and there is no way that is really what's happening. And all you have to do is you have to sit down and you have to probe and you have to talk to the families and you have to try and find out, you know, what is it that's really going on, and how do you try to, you know, move their perception enough that you can help them. And oftentimes, you know, people maybe don't report things because they're afraid, you know, that something's wrong. And I understand that. And I think that we just need to help them. And when we see that there's a parent-centered report, a parent report that's been filled out, and you know that it really, you've never seen it occur that way, then just ask the parent, when did that happen? And actually, you could learn something from them. They'll tell you, well, when we do that, we actually do this first. So the thing is, they've already got a strategy, and that's why that came out okay. So, you know, you've got to talk. You've just got to talk. You cannot walk in to, I don't think you do any patient group or diagnosis, but especially this, because it encompasses so many areas and so many areas where you want to stay in your own lane, but you don't want to miss anything, and you want to guide families appropriately.
So real quick, let me just help kind of clarify for parents that are listening that may be concerned that DCD may be part of what their child is. They would start with a neuropsych. Is that correct? They could.
Or if they notice that their child is having motor difficulties as compared to their peers, you could certainly start with a PT with a motor assessment. If the child is having problems, you know, with their pencil to paper tasks, you could certainly, you know, start with an OT, but you got to know that you got to keep on going, you know, that whoever is assessing that person is going to be consideration, is going to take into consideration all the things that they're observing.
What would it be and why, if we could have, or if you could have, a billboard with one tip for parents? That's my final question.
One tip for parents. Mm-hmm. Well, don't listen to your neighbors. You know, like, I think that's true. I mean, because don't listen to anybody else who says, I have a child and my child has A, and this is what we're doing and it worked. Because we all know that we've never seen two children that are the same. So consider your child an individual and never forget that. Never forget that your child brings to the table strengths that many other children do not have. So my greatest message to parents ever is that your child comes to this world with things that other children don't. And that's going to determine how I proceed, you know, with my intervention. And I really want parents to understand, you know, that there often is, you know, a cognitive linguistic component to this, and that we want to try and prevent participation restrictions so that your child lives a satisfying life with good quality.
Beautiful, beautiful. How can people find you, Terrell?
I can be reached by email, or I can be reached by phone, or my website is www.yourkidnetworked.com.
And we will put all of your contact information in the show notes. I appreciate your time, and thank you for shedding some light on DCD for us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again for listening. It is my hope that you are going to take away some wonderful nuggets and thinking about a cognitive-oriented approach when working with either your student or students within your classroom, and thinking about goal, plan, do, and check. Thank you again for strategizing and spending your precious time listening. If you love what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. You know your kid best, and you know if they're struggling or thriving, if they are happy or losing hope, if they understand or are completely lost. The question is, what now? If you're unsure what steps to take to help your child succeed and need a starting point, take my free quiz. After answering some questions about your child, it will guide you towards the first step in helping your child be the best they can be. You can find that quiz learningessentialsedu.com. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching and educational therapy. Brain Camp is our executive function support model. If you're a parent, we got you covered as well through IEP coaching.